refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. This is the Summer Breeze Session 2016, the third full talk. It's a pleasure and an honor to be practicing with people who have such solid faith in Zazen. Faith that this life is worth paying attention to. Faith that there is treasure to be found within, whatever that means, within. Or maybe you hear that and you think, well, that's not my experience. I don't know who he's referring to. It's just your wishful thinking. Maybe my desire is coloring my perspective, seeing what I want to see. There's a Sufi saying I really like. And it says, in a crowd of saints, a pickpocket sees only wallets. Is thinking you could reverse that and you could say, in a crowd of pickpockets, a saint sees only Buddhas. So what is faith? Is there a thing called faith? Is it something you have or you don't have? Is faith an emotion? Is it a feeling? Does faith come or go? To do this practice, do we need such a thing as faith? Is faith a practice? Can it be generated? Can it be communicated? Can it be cultivated? If this life is as real as a dream, then what is it we can have faith in? What then? Maybe faith is an absence. Maybe faith is an absence. An absence of what? Maybe faith is a presence. But the presence of what? About 4 or 5 years ago, in Sanzen with Harada Roshi, after an unimpressive expression of my koan, at least from his perspective, the Roshi said to me, "You must become more simple. You must become more simple." Very, very impactful. Nobody had ever told me that. And I don't think he was talking about making my wardrobe more drab. Giving up my Radiohead obsession. A little deeper than that. You must become more simple. It stung a little, but that's often what happens when something is true. Hung Chi, I've been pronouncing it wrong. I say Hung Zhi. I think it's closer to Hung Chi. somebody who can pronounce Chinese can correct me later. Hung Chih said, "Dig the pond. Don't wait for the moonlight. Dig the pond. Don't wait for the moonlight. When the pond is complete, the moonlight will naturally be there. Dig the pond. Don't wait for the moonlight. When the pond is complete, the moonlight will naturally be there." Harada Seke says, "Just create the cause. Just cultivate the conditions. When the pond is complete, the moonlight will naturally be there." Is that a matter of now and later? How long does it take for the pond to be complete? Is that one moment or 30 years? When the pond is complete, could raindrops be complete? Could knee pain be complete? Could your longing be complete? Could your silliness be complete? And what kind of mind could that be complete? In other words, is there enough space in us to let arise what arises? With no interference, without distortion in the channel. Could we let this moment display itself as itself with nothing extra? Could we recognize even what is extra as completely extra? It too fitting perfectly in this simple, present, pregnant space. Yes, we can. So Hongzhi said, "Dig the pond. Don't wait for the moonlight. When the pond is complete, the moonlight will naturally be there." And a contemporary poet said, just these two lines, "Like moonlight seen in a well. Like moonlight seen in a well, the one who sees it blocks it." We all have this experience. Like moonlight seen in a well, the one who sees it blocks it. Well, if that's the case, then how would you know if there's ever moonlight in the well? The predicament of the self is funny. From one perspective, there's big humor in this whole endeavor. Big humor. So I'm personally working on not being so serious. It's sort of a remnant of my early years in practice, where I was very, very serious, and probably I couldn't help it. And I put a note on my computer to myself. I like to do that with koans or just teachings. And I put, "Don't be so damn serious." And I was away, and a friend put under that, on a sticky note, seriously. And the sticky note had a printed header, note to self. So Chosen says, take your practice seriously, but yourself lightly. Take the practice seriously, but yourself lightly. On that note, I want to share with you an article from The Onion, America's most trusted news source. Monk gloats over yoga championship. Lhasa, Tibet. Employing the brash style that first brought him to prominence, Sri Dhananjay won the 5th annual international yogi competition yesterday with a world record point total of 873.6. I am the serenest, Dhananjay shouted to the estimated crowd of 20,000 yoga fans, vigorously pumping his fists. No one is serener than Sri Dhananjay. I am the greatest monk of all time. Dhananjay averaged 1.89 breaths a minute during the two-hour competition, nearly 0.3 fewer than his nearest competitor, second-place finisher, and two-time champion Sri Salil the Hammer Gupta. The heavily favored Gupta was upset after the loss. I should be able to beat that guy with one lung tied, Gupta said. I'm beside myself right now, and I don't mean trans bodily. Dhananjay got off to a fast start at the Lhasa meet, which, like most major competitions, is a six-event affair. In the first event, he attained total consciousness, TC, in just 2 minutes, 34 seconds, and set the tone for the rest of the meet by repeatedly shouting, I'm blissful, you blissful, I'm blissful, to the other yogis. Dhananjay, 33, burst onto the international yoga scene with a gold mandala performance at the 94 Bhutan Invitational. At that competition, he premiered his aggressive style, at one point in the flexibility event, sticking his middle toes out at the other yogis. While no prohibition exists against such behavior, according to Yoga League Commissioner Swami Prabhupada, such behavior is generally considered, quote-unquote, un-Buddha-like. I don't care what the critics say, Dhananjay said. Sri Dhananjay is just going to go out there and do Sri Dhananjay's own yoga thing. Before the Bhutan meet, Dhananjay had never placed better than fourth. Many said he had forsaken rigorous training for the celebrity status accorded by his Bhutan win, endorsing Nike's new line of prayer mats. But his performance this week will regain for him the number one computer ranking and earn him new respect, as well as for his coach Mahananda Vasti, the controversial guru some have called Dhananjay's guru. His guru said, my special training diet for Dhananjay of one supercharged, carbo-loaded grain of rice per day was essential to his win, Vasti said. The defeated Gupta denied that Dhananjay's taunting was a factor in his inability to attain TC. I just wasn't myself today, Gupta commented. I wasn't any self today. I was an egoless particle of the universal no soul. In the second event, flexibility, Dhananjay maintained the lead by supporting himself on his index fingers for the entire 15 minutes while touching the back of his skull to his lower spine. The feat was matched by Gupta, who first used the position at the 1990 Tokyo Zenoff. That's my meditative position of spiritual ecstasy, not his, remarked Gupta. He stole my thunder. Dhananjay denied the charge, saying, Gupta has been talking like that ever since he was a 3rd-century Egyptian slave owner. Nevertheless, a strong showing by Gupta in the third event, the shot put, placed him within a lotus petal of the lead at the competition's halfway point. But event number four, the contemplation of unanswerable riddles known as koans, provide the key to victory for Dhananjay. The koan had long been thought the weak point of his spiritual arsenal, but his response to today's riddle, "Show me the face before you had been born," was reportedly, in quotes, "extremely illuminative," according to Commissioner Prabhupada. While koan answers are kept secret from the public for fear of exposing the uninitiated multitudes to the terror of universal truth, insiders claim his answer had Prabhupada and the two other judges highly enlightened. Practice can be viewed in many ways. And just as this session is viewed in many different ways. You could say there are as many different session happening as there are people. Where does the experience we're calling session reside? Where does the experience of your session reside? Are each of us hearing the same voice or a different voice? Where does the experience we call session or the monastery, where does that reside? One person is dwelling in heaven, another dwelling in hell. Some are just dwelling in Klatskanai. That was a joke. For some, Zazen is experienced as an activity they are doing inside their head. Their experience is that this is an internal mental activity that's happening within the bounds of their skull. And some are experiencing Zazen as a limitless, lucid embrace. Where does the real session reside? In a way, truly, this is all hearsay. It's all hearsay. Why is it only hearsay? Only you feel the beating of your heart. It could not possibly be shared. Only you sit where you sit, seeing, hearing, feeling, thinking. Only you sit where you sit in your realm of experience. Everything else is hearsay. Everything else is the beautiful but delusory functioning of imagination. Only you sit where you sit, seeing, hearing, feeling, thinking. Nobody else knows. The taste on the tongue is yours. The sound in the ears is yours. The thoughts in the mind are yours. I like to think of session as a celebration. It's a celebration or a manifesting of perfection. So sometimes people come, for example, into interview and they say, well, yeah, that's right. Everything's perfect. Nothing needs to be done. So why bother with this? All is whole and complete, why practice? It's a very good question. It's a very good question. But to me, a more honest question is, what happens in your life when you don't practice? What happens in our minds when we lose mindfulness for even a few minutes? How quickly does it turn from heaven to hell? What happens in our minds when we lose mindfulness for a few days or a few years? It's a celebration of perfection to sit in oneness with what is. And yet, as soon as we stop celebrating, as soon as we stop manifesting that, then what's your experience? Our diligence matters. Our diligence matters. And yet always we are within the way. The way is our diligence, even our desperation. And yet, the moment is always refreshing. Not refreshing like Mountain Dew refreshing, but the moment is always refreshing. The field is always clear. The field is always clear. Embracing all sound, silence. Perhaps pervading even our most complicated neuroses, stillness. Available to us is an intrinsic redemption in being the now. What we mean by atonement. At one with the moment, atonement. Intrinsic redemption in being the now. Doesn't mean there's no consequences to action. Doesn't mean we do whatever we want. Intrinsic redemption in being the now because it's refreshing. This is time. And when we say being the now, we're not talking about the relationship to time that sees now as a point between a history of failures and a future we need to control and fear. How big is right now? By what are you convinced that there's something behind you and something ahead? Can you step into fully this nowness? The refreshing, the field that is always clear. The precious Sesshin container bathes us in silence, I like to say we marinate in it. We marinate in silence. And however we rattle around in that, or resist that, or relish it, it seems to me it still teaches. That it still heals. I'm going to read from David White on silence. Silence is frightening, an intimation of the end, the graveyard of fixed identities. Real silence puts any present understanding to shame, orphans us from certainty, leads us beyond the well-known and accepted reality, and confronts us with the unknown and previously unacceptable. Silence does not end skepticism, but makes it irrelevant. Interesting comment on faith. Silence does not end skepticism, but makes it irrelevant. Belief or unbelief or any previously rehearsed story meets the wind in the trees, the distant horn in the busy arbor, or the watching eye and listening ear of a puzzled loved one. In silence, essence speaks to us of essence itself, and asks for a kind of unilateral disarmament. In silence, essence speaks to us of essence itself and asks for a kind of unilateral disarmament, our own essential nature slowly emerging as the defended periphery atomizes and falls apart. As the busy edge dissolves, we begin to join the conversation through the portal of a present unknowing, robust vulnerability, revealing in the way we listen, with a different ear, a more perceptive eye, an imagination refusing to come too early to a conclusion, and belonging to a different person than the one who first entered the quiet. Out of the quiet emerges the sheer presence of the world, a presence that seems to demand an internal symmetry in the one breathing and listening equal to its own breathing and listening. To become deeply silent is not merely to become still, but to become tidal and seasonal, a coming and going that has its own inimitable essential character, a story not fully told, like the background of the sea or the rain falling on the river, going on, out of sight, out of our lives. Reality met on its own terms demands absolute presence. Reality met on its own terms demands absolute presence and absolute giving away. An ability to live on equal terms with the fleeting and the eternal, the untouchable and the fully possible. A full bodily appearance and disappearance, a rested giving in and giving up. Another identity braver, more generous, and more here. Another identity braver, more generous, and more here than the one looking hungrily for the easy, unearned answer. Silence is not created. The silence is not something that lacks a voice. The silence is the mouth, is the portal for all the speech of the world. Another koan from our lineage batch. Sei Kenko of Cho. In the old days, monks and teachers were named after the mountain that they dwelled on. It tells you something about how they understood the self. They gave up their personal name, and often they took up the mountain name. Of identity is that? Sei Kenko of Cho composed a poem as he was enlightened upon hearing the thunder strike. Now that kind of made me laugh. I mean, as he was enlightened, he started writing a poem? Okay. So we edit that a bit. Sei Kenko of Cho composed a poem after he was enlightened. Upon hearing a thunder strike. This is his poem. Now, part of the way this used to work is if you lived remote from your teacher and you had an insight and you wanted to see, was this durable? Was this the real thing? One of the snags of Dharma practice is that we can actually not know the difference between a concept and an actual experience. It's very humbling. We can read about impermanence and think we actually know what impermanence is because we hear the words and we go, oh yeah, of course, impermanence. The same thing happens with the Dharma from the top to the bottom. I met a monk who asked me, why would you spend all this time in meditation investigating your true nature when you can just open the sutras and they tell you exactly how it is? Now, maybe I'm the fool, but we have to be very, very careful about the teachings. It's running on razor blades. So, when you lived remote from your teacher, one of the ways that you would get approval, this was part of the way, is that somebody who you have faith has a more encompassing clarity has to give you the seal of approval. It's kind of interesting. Because you don't need approval, and yet, somehow approval. So they would write a poem and present it, and the teacher, by the quality of the poem, and the depth of the expression could judge. So anyway, this is Sei Kenko's poem. Sitting in the room in absolute silence, mind source unmoved, filled like still water. The striking of thunder has opened the head's crown. Beginningless self nature has awakened. Sitting in the room in absolute silence, mind source unmoved, filled like still water, the striking of thunder has opened the head's crown. Beginningless self-nature has awakened. And then the koan says, which line is most important? That's where the test is. Which line is most important? Sitting in the room in absolute silence. Mind source unmoved, filled like still water. The striking of thunder has opened the head's crown. Beginningless self-nature has awakened. So all these words, silence, space, source, mind, awareness, these words are terribly inadequate. Terribly inadequate, of course. And yet these inadequate words are crucially pointing at the element of freedom. Crucially pointing at the element of freedom that is so close, so intimate, so simple, so desired, and yet little poem by Jane Hirschfield. It's called Late Prayer. Late Prayer. Tenderness does not choose its own uses. Tenderness does not choose its own uses. It goes out to everything equally, circling rabbit and hawk. It goes out to everything equally, circling rabbit and hawk. Look, in the iron bucket, a single nail, a single ruby, all the heavens and hells. They rattle in the heart and make one sound. Look, in the iron bucket, a single nail, a single ruby, all the heavens and hells. They rattle in the heart and make one sound. Don't take it as remote. Don't hear it as lofty attainment. Right now, relax. Open. Allow everything with no interference. Experience this moment with no partiality or contraction. And there's a glimpse. Now, sometimes I feel a little bit like a taskmaster. That part of my job is to encourage you to do a work that you might not want to do or is not very pleasant. And even so, it needs to be said. It helps to still the thinking mind. But mostly, so the radiance isn't bound up and droned out by all the brain banter. So Dogen says, think, not thinking. Obviously, you're not trying to cut off blood flow to your brain. Detach from it. Detach from it. In the Buddhist map of the self, thinking is just another sense. It's called mind consciousness. Just as without your will, the eyes see, without your effort, the ears hear, without our effort, the mind thinks. Uchiyama said, the brain secretes thoughts. We add an extra idea to that. The brain secretes thoughts. Detach from it. For the more poetic souls, be the silent eye. Be the silent eye that is unmoved amidst the moving. Be the silent eye that is unmoved amidst the moving. Think non-thinking. If you want to really see the wildflowers, you can't do so with a gauze of judgment and label, if you want to really see them, you have to think non-thinking. You have to let the 10,000 dharmas express themselves. And one moment is good. And 100 moments is good. So isn't it okay that we have this work before us? Why should we not have training? Why should we not have the struggle of the spiritual path? It's a phase. It's a time of cultivation. And if we try to avoid or skip the cultivation of transparent presence, won't the gates of the mystery remain closed? If we don't learn to see with the eye of non-thinking, then how could our dharma not just be ideas and concepts? One moment is good. 100 moments is good. Shakyamuni Buddha is quoted as saying, the Dharma path is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. Good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. And who in the world can say where we're at? Good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Good when moving, good when still, good when frustrated, good when at ease. On a practical note, a practice I have found very useful over the years is on breaks, if you're tired, to lie down on a bed, maybe in corpse pose, and do full deep relaxation of the whole body. Let the body melt. Let a total surrender to gravity. And along with that, let the mind just be empty and filled with all of this. Because sometimes the fruit of our sincerity here in the Zendo doesn't necessarily show up here in the Zendo, at least in the relative sense. You may, because of your intensity, your diligence, sit on the jhana and find yourself with a very expansive, luminous mind. Or a yogi, sitting on the bench drinking a cup of tea, lying in bed. So that practice of deep release, anything we're holding, very, very good use of the break time. And if you fall asleep in that state, that's pretty interesting. To carry the quiet mind, or even further, the lucid awareness across the barrier from waking to sleep. Very interesting. Good when moving, good when still, good when at ease, and good when frustrated. If there's frustration, maybe what we're feeling is our latent potential. Because if you didn't buy all of this, if you didn't give two shakes, there wouldn't be any frustration. Would there? The frustration we feel is a calling out, is the voice of our own potential. Maybe you could say our frustration is the heart pushing against the limits it currently lives within. And so some dis-ease, some frustration rises to the surface. So we shouldn't avoid or dislike effort, dislike frustration. We shouldn't think our passion has no room in this way. So whether the aspiration is burning low or burning high, simply keep it lit. Keep it lit. Nothing is fixed. Nothing is fixed.